Unit 5, The Growing Nation, 1820 to 1860. Why it matters. As you study Unit 5, you will learn how growth, migration, and conflict increased following the Industrial Revolution. Chapter 11, The Jackson Era, 1824 to 1845. Why it matters. The struggle for political rights took shape in the 1820s and 1830s, when many people questioned the limits of American democracy. The impact today. In the years since the Jackson era, women, African Americans, and other minorities have won the right to vote and to participate in the political process. Today, every United States citizen aged 18 or older, regardless of gender, race, or wealth, has the right to vote. Section 1. Jacksonian Democracy. An American Story. The presidential campaign of 1828 was one of the most vicious in American history. Supporters of John Quincy Adams in Philadelphia distributed a pamphlet titled An Account of Some of the Bloody Deeds of General Jackson. One illustration in the pamphlet showed a ferocious-looking Andrew Jackson plunging his sword through the body of a helpless civilian. Meanwhile, Jackson supporters falsely accused John Quincy Adams of kidnapping a young American girl and selling her to the ruler of Russia. The election of 1824. From 1816 to 1824, the United States had only one political party, the Jeffersonian Republicans. Within the party, however, differences arose among various groups that had their own views and interests. In 1824, James Monroe was finishing his second term as president, but declined to run for a third term. Four candidates from the Republican Party competed for the presidency. The four candidates' opinions differed on the role of the federal government. They also spoke for different parts of the country. The Republican Party nominated William H. Crawford, a former congressman from Georgia. However, Crawford's poor health weakened him as a candidate. The other three Republicans in the presidential race were favorite son candidates, meaning they received the backing of their home states rather than that of the National Party. Two of these candidates, Andrew Jackson and Henry Clay, came from the West. Clay of Kentucky was Speaker of the House of Representatives. He fought for his program of internal improvements, high tariffs, and a stronger national bank. General Andrew Jackson of Tennessee was not a Washington politician, but he was a hero of the War of 1812. Raised in poverty, he claimed to speak for the Americans who had been left out of politics. John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts, son of former President John Adams, received support from merchants of the Northeast. Striking a bargain. In the election, Jackson received the largest number of popular votes. However, no candidate received a majority or more than half of the electoral votes. Jackson won 99 electoral votes, which gave him a plurality, or largest single share. Under the terms of the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, when no candidate receives a majority of electoral votes, the House of Representatives selects the president. While the House was preparing to vote on the next president, Henry Clay met with Adams. Clay agreed to use his influence as Speaker of the House to defeat Jackson. In return, Clay may have hoped to gain the position of Secretary of State. With Clay's help, Adams was elected president in the House. Adams quickly named Clay as Secretary of State, traditionally the stepping stone to the presidency. Jackson's followers accused the two men of making a corrupt bargain and stealing the election. The Adams Presidency. In Washington, D.C., the corrupt bargain had cast a shadow over Adams' presidency. Outside the Capitol, Adams' policies ran against popular opinion. Adams wanted a stronger navy and government funds for scientific expeditions. Adams also wanted the federal government to direct economic growth. Such ideas horrified those who desired a more limited role for the federal government, and Congress turned down many of Adams' proposals. This was especially true after the congressional elections of 1826, when enemies of Adams controlled both the House and Senate. Reading check. Describing. Why were Adams and Clay accused of making a corrupt bargain? The election of 1828. By the election of 1828, the party had divided into two separate parties, the Democratic Republicans, who supported Jackson, and the National Republicans, who supported Adams. Jackson's Democratic Republicans, or Democrats, favored states' rights and mistrusted strong central government. Many Democrats were individualists from the frontier, immigrants, or laborers in the big cities. The National Republicans wanted a strong central government. They supported federal measures such as road building and the Bank of the United States that would shape the nation's economy. Many were merchants or farmers. During the campaign, both parties resorted to mudslinging, attempts to ruin their opponent's reputation with insults. The Democratic Republicans accused Adams of betraying the people. They put out a handbill calling the election a contest between an honest patriotism on the one side and an unholy, selfish ambition on the other. The National Republicans fought back. They created a vicious campaign song to play up embarrassing incidents in Jackson's life. One involved Jackson's order in the War of 1812 to execute several soldiers who had deserted. Mudslinging was not the only new element introduced in the 1828 campaign. Election slogans, rallies, buttons, and events such as barbecues were also used to arouse enthusiasm. All of these new features became a permanent part of American political life. Jackson triumphs. In the election of 1828, Jackson received most of the votes cast by voters of the new frontier states. He also received many votes in the South, where his support for states' rights was popular. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, who had served as Adams' vice president, switched parties to run with Jackson. Calhoun also championed states' rights. Jackson won the election in a landslide, an overwhelming victory, with 56% of the popular vote and 178 electoral votes. Reading check. Summarizing. How did Jackson try to get the support of people in the election of 1828? Jackson as president. Andrew Jackson was everything most Americans admired, a patriot, a self-made man, and a war hero. On March 4th, 1829, thousands of farmers, laborers, and other ordinary Americans crowded into the nation's capital to hear Jackson's inaugural address. After Jackson's speech, a crowd joined him at a White House reception. They filled the elegant rooms of the mansion, trampling on the carpets with muddy shoes, spilling food on sofas and chairs. They were there to shake the hand of the general who seemed just like them. Old Hickory. Like many of his supporters, Andrew Jackson had been born in a log cabin. His parents, poor farmers, died before he was 15. As a teenager, Jackson fought with the Patriots in the American Revolution. Before he was 30, he was elected to Congress from Tennessee. Jackson gained fame during the War of 1812. He defeated the Creek Nation in the Battle of Horseshoe Bend and defeated the British at the Battle of New Orleans. His troops called him Old Hickory because he was as tough as a hickory stick. Small farmers, craft workers, and others who felt left out of the expanding American economy loved Jackson. They felt that his rise from a log cabin to the White House demonstrated the American success story. His popularity with the common man changed politics in Washington, D.C. Citizenship. New voters. President Andrew Jackson promised equal protection and equal benefits for all Americans, at least for all white American men. During his first term, a spirit of equality spread through American politics. In the nation's early years, most states had limited suffrage, or the right to vote, for men who owned property or paid taxes. Starting in 1815, western and eastern states alike loosened the property requirements for voting. In the 1820s, democracy expanded as people who had not been allowed to vote voted for the first time. Between 1824 and 1828, the percentage of white males voting in presidential elections increased from 36.9% to 57.6%. For the first time, white male sharecroppers, factory workers, and many others were brought into the political process. The expansion of suffrage continued, and in 1840, more than 80% of white males voted in the presidential election. However, women still could not vote, and African Americans and Native Americans had few rights of any kind. Another development in the broadening of democracy involved presidential electors. By 1828, 22 of the 24 states changed their constitutions to allow the people, rather than the state legislatures, to choose presidential electors. The spoils system. Democrats carried the spirit of democracy into government. They wanted to open up government jobs to people from all walks of life. They were disturbed that the federal government had become a bureaucracy, a system in which non-elected officials carry out laws. Democrats argued that ordinary citizens could handle any government job. President Jackson fired many federal workers and replaced them with his supporters. The discharged employees protested vehemently. They charged that Jackson was acting like a tyrant, hiring and firing people at will. Jackson responded that a new set of federal employees would be good for democracy. One Jackson supporter explained it another way. To the victors belong the spoils. In other words, because the Jacksonians had won the election, they had the right to the spoils, benefits of victory, such as handing out government jobs to supporters. The practice of replacing government employees with the winning candidate's supporters became known as the spoils system. Electoral changes. Jackson supporters worked to make the political system more democratic as well. They abandoned the unpopular caucus system. In this system, major political candidates were chosen by committees made up of members of Congress. The caucuses were replaced by nominating conventions in which delegates from the state selected the party's presidential candidate. The Democrats held their first national party convention in 1832 in Baltimore, Maryland. The convention drew delegates from each state in the Union. The delegates decided to nominate the candidate who could gather two-thirds of the vote, and Jackson won the nomination. This system allowed many people to participate in the selection of political candidates. Reading check. Describing. What is a caucus system? Economics. The tariff debate. Americans from different parts of the country disagreed strongly on some issues. One such issue was the tariff, a fee paid by merchants who imported goods. While president, Jackson faced a tariff crisis that tested the national government's powers. In 1828, Congress passed a very high tariff on manufactured goods from Europe. Manufacturers in the United States, mostly in the Northeast, welcomed the tariff. Because tariffs made European goods more expensive, American consumers were more likely to buy American-made goods. Southerners, however, hated the new tariff. They called it the Tariff of Abominations, something hateful. These critics argued that while tariffs forced consumers to buy American goods, tariffs also meant higher prices. The South protests. Southern politicians and plantation owners were ready to act. Vice President John C. Calhoun argued that a state or group of states had the right to nullify or cancel a federal law it considered against state interests. Some Southerners called for the Southern states to secede or break away from the United States and form their own government. When Calhoun explored this idea, troubling questions arose. The United States had been a nation for nearly 50 years. What if a state disagreed with the federal government? Did a state have the right to go its own way? Calhoun drew from the ideas that Madison and Jefferson wrote in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and 1799. Calhoun argued that since the federal government was a creation of the states themselves are the final authority of the constitutionality of federal laws. The alternative to state sovereignty, Calhoun pointed out, is to allow the Supreme Court or Congress to tell the people what our Constitution means and what orders we must obey. The Webster-Hayne debate. In January 1830, Senator Daniel Webster delivered a stinging attack on nullification. Webster stood on the floor of the Senate to challenge a speech given by Robert Hayne, a young senator from North Carolina. Hayne had defended the idea that the states had a right to nullify acts of the federal government, and even to secede. In his response, Webster defended the Constitution and the Union. He argued that nullification could only mean the end of the Union. Webster closed with the ringing statement, "Liberty and Union, now and forever, one and inseparable." Jackson takes a stand. Nobody knew exactly where President Jackson stood on the issue of nullification. Many Southerners hoped that Jackson might side with them. In April 1830, supporters of states' rights invited the president to speak at a dinner. The guests, including Calhoun, waited anxiously for Jackson to speak. Finally, the president rose to his feet and spoke directly to Calhoun. "Our federal union must be preserved." The states' rights supporters were shocked and disappointed, but Calhoun answered the president's challenge. He raised his glass and said, "The Union, next to our liberty, most dear." He meant that the fate of the Union must take second place to a state's liberty to overrule the Constitution if its interests were threatened. Calhoun realized that Jackson would not change his views. Wishing to return to Congress to speak for Southern interests, Calhoun won election to the Senate in December 1832. 2 weeks later, he resigned the vice presidency. The Nullification Crisis. Southern anger over the tariff continued to build. The Union seemed on the verge of splitting apart. In 1832, Congress passed a new lower tariff, hoping that the protest in the South would die down. It did not. South Carolina, Calhoun's home state, had led the fight against the so-called Tariff of Abominations. Now South Carolina took the battle one step further. The state legislature passed the Nullification Act, declaring that it would not pay the illegal tariffs of 1828 and 1832. The South Carolina legislators threatened to secede from the Union if the federal government tried to interfere with their actions. To ease the crisis, Jackson supported a compromise bill proposed by Henry Clay that would greatly lower the tariff. At the same time, Jackson made sure that the South would accept Clay's compromise. Early in 1833, he persuaded Congress to pass the Force Bill, which allowed the president to use the United States military to enforce acts of Congress. The message was clear. If South Carolina did not give in, it would face the army. In response, South Carolina voted to nullify the Force Act. Calhoun and his followers claimed a victory for nullification, which had, they insisted, forced the revision of the tariff. For the time being, the crisis between a state and the federal government was over. Yet South Carolina and the rest of the South would remember the lesson of the Nullification Crisis, that the federal government would not allow a state to go its own way without a fight. Reading check. Summarizing. Why did South Carolina pass the Nullification Act? Study and writing skill builder. Analyzing primary sources. Why learn this skill? Historians determine what happened in the past by combing through bits of evidence to reconstruct events. This evidence, both written and illustrated, is called primary sources. Examining primary sources can help you understand history. Learning the skill. Primary sources are records of events made by the people who witnessed them. They include letters, diaries, photographs and pictures, news articles, and legal documents. To analyze primary sources, follow these steps. Identify when and where the document was written. Read the document for its content and try to answer the 5 W questions. Who is it about? What is it about? When did it happen? Where did it happen? Why did it happen? Identify the author's opinions. Practicing the skill. The primary source that follows comes from Speckled Snake, an elder of the Creek Nation in 1829. He was more than 100 years old at the time he said these words. Read the quote, then answer the questions that follow. Brothers, I have listened to many talks from our great father. When he first came over the wide waters, he was but a little man. But when the white man had warmed himself before the Indians' fire and filled himself with their hominy, he became very large. With a step he bestrode the mountains, and his feet covered the plains and the valleys. His hand grasped the eastern and the western sea, and his head rested on the moon. Then he became our great father. Brothers, I have listened to a great many talks from our great father, but they always began and ended in this: get a little further. You are too near me. 1. What events are described? 2. Who was affected by these events? And 3. What is the general feeling of the person who stated this opinion? Applying the skill. Analyzing primary sources. Find a primary source from your past. A photograph, a report card, an old newspaper clipping, or your first baseball card. Bring this source to class and explain what it shows about that time in your life. Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM Level 1 provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills.